Okay. We are ready to pick up, I believe. We were looking at the Celtic Christians, and we're ready to pick up with the real story of St. Patrick. Let me say the famous Catholic story of St. Patrick has no bearing to truth or reality in the least. But the real story is a tremendous one. One of the most famous and most touching stories of church history took place during this period. We're talking about the era of the Celtic Christians. About 385 AD in the village of Banavern, a boy was born. His father, Calpurnius, and it should be say Calpurnius there. Got a confusion between the R and the N. Calpurnius was a deacon in the independent church there. The boy was named Succat, S-U-C-C-A-T, though he would be remembered in church history as Patrick. Though raised in a Christian home, as a teenager, he became very rebellious toward Christian truth. Not exactly the first or last time that's happened. Raised in a Christian home, as a teenager, he became very rebellious toward Christian truth. At age 16, he was kidnapped by Irish pirates and sold as a slave to a pagan Irish chief. Might say that Banavern was in Scotland. Patrick became the keeper of the swine for this chief. While alone keeping the swine, he remembered the teaching of his parents. And he put his faith and trust in the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. At age 22, he escaped from his master who had been mistreating him. Following his escape, he returned to his family. After studying and training to become a preacher, Patrick became burdened for the Irish tribe with whom he had lived as a slave. His family and friends tried to dissuade him, but he determined to go back there as a missionary. He gathered the pagan tribes in fields near their village. And preached the gospel to them. He baptized all those converts by immersion and then formed local churches for them. The son of a tribal chieftain, Benignus, was converted, and Patrick trained him as a preacher. Benignus also baptized thousands of converts. Many more independent churches were formed through their ministries, over 300. And that number relates to those two men, and you couldn't break it down between the two of them. But the result of their gospel endeavors in Ireland resulted in over 300 independent churches being formed. Patrick wrote and taught against slavery. And he is sometimes given credit for being the first person ever to speak unequivocally against slavery. Today, we look at slavery as evil, you know, almost all over the world, and we take it for granted that that was the sense that people had throughout the ages, but it wasn't. Slavery was considered part of the natural order of things in many places for a long time, even still occasionally is find places. But he taught against it. And of course, he knew something about slavery having been one. He taught against it and would influence Ireland against slavery. Well, several of Patrick's writings and songs are available today. One of his songs includes this stanza about his dependence on Christ. Christ has shielded me today against poison, against burning, against drowning, against wounding, so that there may come to me abundance of reward. Christ with me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ in me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ on my right, Christ on my left, Christ when I lie down, Christ when I sit down, Christ when I arise. Another stanza shows his personal focus on the Lord. I arise today through God's strength to pilot me, God's might to uphold me, God's wisdom to guide me, God's eye to look before me, God's ear to hear me, God's word to speak to me, God's hand to guard me, God's way to lie before me, God's shield to protect me, God's host to save me from snares of devils, from temptations of vices, from everyone who shall wish me ill, afar and anear, alone and in multitude. Well, Patrick's preaching ministry lasted for 30 years. So many people were converted that pagan practices of immorality and human sacrifice were no longer carried out in the open. Pagan practices of immorality and human sacrifice were no longer carried out in the open. I'm not saying that this stuff didn't happen, but it wasn't public. It wasn't part of the culture. It wasn't lifted up. Okay. Thomas Cahill described the change this way. Something new, something never seen before. A Christian culture where slavery and human sacrifice became unthinkable, and warfare, though impossible for humans to eradicate, diminished markedly. That's from Cahill's book, How the Irish Saved Civilization. Cahill also wrote, Ireland is unique in religious history for being the only land into which Christianity was introduced without bloodshed. Without bloodshed. Now, sometimes the bloodshed was the early missionaries and preachers going there being persecuted. Sometimes the bloodshed was Catholic armies coming in and conquest. He said Ireland, at that time, was the first place Christianity was introduced without there being any shedding of blood. In spite of his family's understandable worries, when he went back to the people where he'd been a slave, he was not persecuted. He was not killed. And God did a tremendous, tremendous work there, which illustrates the old point again, the safest place to be is in the center of God's will. Patrick appears to have believed most of the Baptist distinctives. However, there's some question as to whether or not he accepted the Bible as the sole or final authority. As the sole or final authority. He's mighty close to being a Baptist if he wasn't. He definitely held to all of the others. The later attempt by Roman Catholicism to claim St. Patrick as one of their representatives was strictly political and had absolutely no basis in historical fact. No basis in historical fact. The Roman Catholic legend, his greatest accomplishment is playing the flute and getting all the snakes to follow him into the sea and drown so that Ireland would be snake-free. In reality, his great contribution was preaching the gospel, winning people to Christ, baptizing them, and organizing them into local independent churches. For some strange reasons, that's not a story Roman Catholicism wants to tell. Columba, still under the Celtic Christians. In the 6th century, in one of the independent Irish churches formed by Patrick, a young man named Columba decided to go as a missionary to Scotland. Now watch this. Where does Ireland get the gospel from? Scotland. Some years later, where are they sending a missionary to? Scotland. That may seem strange, but it may not be long in the United States till we need some of the places where we sent missionaries to and built churches and strong movements developed to send missionaries back here. It gets frightening here these days. And anyway, Columba decided to go as a missionary to Scotland. He was the grandson of a local Irish king. A church was built on a small island known as Iona. And from there, missionaries traveled throughout Scotland. So they went to a Scottish island, started a church, and this church becomes famous for its investment in missions. Okay. Many young men came to Iona to study. They were taught every one of the Baptist distinctives, and they spread those ideas throughout Scotland. Iona became a college for Baptist missionaries. I think that is a fair statement because there's historical record of them teaching all of the Baptist distinctives. And this church developed such an interest in missions that young men from around Europe came to this church to study and be trained as missionaries. Eventually, missionaries traveled from Iona throughout Europe. They came there, and then they go back, spread throughout Europe, preaching the gospel. Unfortunately, their attempts to take the gospel to the Saxon invaders of England constantly met with failure. There is not a record of them having success. They sent preachers there, but there's not a record of them having success getting churches started. Winston Churchill described this period of time this way. His history, The Birth of Britain. It was therefore in Ireland and not in Wales or England that the light of Christianity now burned and gleamed throughout the darkness. It was from Ireland that the gospel was carried, still under Churchill, gospel was carried to the north of Britain and for the first time cast its redeeming spell upon the Pictish invaders. Columba, born half a century after St. Patrick's death, but an offspring of his church, and imbued with his grace and fire, proved a new champion of the faith. From the monastery which he established in the island of Iona, his disciples went forth to the British kingdom of Strathclyde, to the Pictish tribes of the north, to the Anglian kingdom of Northumbria. He is the founder of the Scottish Christian Church. Now, we know that's not completely true because Patrick came from a Christian church. But it is the influence of Columba that causes Christianity to be very open and widespread. Thus, the message which St. Patrick had carried to Ireland came back across the stormy waters and spread through wide regions. Finally, the Roman, E is the Roman Catholic military conquest. Okay, England, Ireland, Scotland, so forth, become Catholic by military conquest, by force. Finally, the Roman Pope, known as Gregory the Great. We mentioned earlier in our discussion about the first pope. Some would suggest him as the first pope because he's the first one whose his authority spreads wider than anybody before him. And in history, when they call somebody the great, that doesn't mean good, that means influential. He was certainly influential. You couldn't call him Gregory the Good, but you could call him Gregory the Great. Well, he determined to bring the British Christians under the control of Rome. A constant struggle then broke out between Roman Catholicism, backed by the Germanic tribes, the Angles and the Saxons, who had invaded England, and the Celtics for control of their previously independent churches. The Angles and Saxons were Germanic tribes that had invaded Britain. Three church councils were held, and at all three councils, the independent churches refused the control of Rome. So we had three big public meetings. They invite all the preachers. They try to persuade them to unite, Celtic Christians to unite with Rome. In all three cases, they refuse. They were independent churches. They were determined to hang on to their independence. But the swords of the Saxons accomplished what church councils could not. The Saxons began to conquer areas they had previously had not controlled. And they continually executed independent Christian preachers. They executed independent Christian preachers. And burned or seized independent church buildings. So this is very much a religious conquest. The Germanic tribes, the Angles and the Saxons, are endorsed by the Catholic Church to conquer. And they're fighting the Celtic Christians, who's in the Celtic areas, they had independent churches. So they saw the preachers in the churches as the enemy. So the Saxons are constantly killing independent preachers and burning church buildings. During this time, a Saxon king, Oswald, and his brother Oswiu were converted, baptized by immersion, and convinced of the need for a separation of church and state. Oswald and Oswiu, O-S-W-I-U, were converted, baptized by immersion, convinced of the need for separate church and state. They, with a few other Saxons, now identified themselves with the Celtic Christians. They changed sides. Got saved, got baptized, and changed sides in this war. And they began to fight with the Celtic Christians against the other Saxons and the Roman Catholic Church. Oswald desired to return as a missionary to the Saxons, but he was compelled to become the military leader of the Celtics. He simply had those military skills and experience that even though he wanted to leave warfare and become a missionary, he was pleaded with. He was the obvious man to be the military leader. He conquered the area of Northumbria and restored the independent churches there. Restored. He called for missionaries from Iona. One missionary, Aidan, was especially successful in reaching the Saxons of the area for Christ. After ruling for 9 years, Oswald was slain fighting against another of the Germanic tribes, which had been sent by the Roman Catholics to fight against him. He was succeeded by his brother Oswiu in the north and another relative, Oswine, in the south. Oswiu determined to rule the entire area and had Oswine assassinated. To solidify his rule and his relations with the other Germanic tribes, Oswiu converted to Roman Catholicism. So he starts out Catholic, makes a profession of faith, gets baptized, becomes a defender of the independent churches. Then in order to rule over the area, he reconverts to Catholicism and becomes the enemy of the churches that he had previously defended. To solidify his rule and his relations with the other Germanic tribes, Oswiu converted to Roman Catholicism and became the enemy of the independent churches for which he had once fought. Throughout England, Roman Catholicism became dominant. The Roman Catholic Church then set out to take control of Iona and thus of Scotland. They even succeeded in winning over the pastor of the church at Iona. I mean, where this had been a missionary church, training missionaries to go out throughout Europe, teaching the gospel, teaching Baptist distinctives, the Roman Catholic Church now persuades the pastor at that time to join them and become Catholic. But he was quickly removed by his people. The people threw him out as pastor. Finally, a Roman Catholic priest named Egbert persuaded the Iona church to unite with Rome. While many independent churches and believers remained faithful, the independent Celtic Christian churches never again became the most dominant religious movement of England. They didn't cease to exist altogether, but by now Roman Catholic control has spread so far, And you read the story of a church like Iona, great missionary church. Then it becomes a Catholic church a few generations later. That ought to be a challenge to everybody to build carefully for the future, because it's amazing how quickly a church can change. The fairly famous set of commentaries by Joseph Parker, great evangelical church, evangelical preacher in England, independent church. Two generations after Parker was gone, that church was Jehovah's Witness. I mean, it is very, very important. And you see this sometimes with men who themselves are very good, but they don't sink the roots of the church deeply. And a generation later or two generations later, somebody comes along and drastically changes what the church was. Later this week, we'll talk about the First Baptist Church in what is now the United States in Rhode Island. That's a modernist church today. Nothing resembling what it's still there, it's still open, but nothing resembling what it was when it was founded. And that is a lesson and a challenge for everybody that's going to be in the Lord's work anywhere. You have to build deep roots into the truth. Well, Roman numeral 5, Baptist heroes of the Dark Ages, and there are many of them. And let me say this about the historical term, the Dark Ages. Dark Ages weren't necessarily as dark as they're painted out to be. During the Dark Ages, there's very little central control and very little record of things. But I think there's some indication that independent preachers and independent churches flourished during this time precisely because there wasn't much central control to be in their way. So the Dark Ages may be thought of as dark by the average world history teacher. By the average Baptist history teacher, it's not such a bad time. The truth keeps popping up everywhere. Well, first of all, the Albigenses. The little city of Albi in southern France became the center of tremendous religious controversy. It was in Albi a number of independent churches defied the Roman Catholic establishment. Soon, independent churches throughout France carried the name of the little town of Albi as they became known as Albigenses. Okay. Start out, you have several independent churches in this region. And so people begin to describe all independent churches with this name. Well, you're like those folks over in Albi, Albigenses. So the name sticks. We said many of the names applied to true churches were geographic names. So that's what happens here. It was common among these independent churches to baptize believers only, to advocate separation of church and state, the priesthood of believers, and soul liberty. Some of the churches and preachers went even further and taught the sole authority scripture. Many of the independent churches called Albigenses were legitimate Baptist churches. Again, you've got to be careful when you describe a group of independent churches, and you can't say they're all this, because independent churches believe whatever they choose to believe, and they practice whatever they choose to practice. Most of the churches claim to be derived directly from the apostles, either through the Paulicians or through an earlier French group called the Cathari. Many of the famous Cathari were heretics. But again, remember what we said repeatedly. What a group is when it starts and what it is a couple hundred years later is often dramatically different. Excuse me. But by the time you get farther along in Cathari history, some of their more famous preachers are really terrible doctrinal heretics. But that's not how the movement starts. The movement starts by emphasizing what people call pure churches. What they meant by pure churches is that you had to be saved to be a member of the church. That is a New Testament truth. Later on down the road, they became, as a movement, it becomes horribly heretical. But it doesn't begin that way. Well, The Cathari got their name, which meant purest. They got their name, which meant purest, by insisting upon a regenerated membership in their independent churches. Insisting upon a regenerated membership. Most of the original Cathari seemed to be Baptist, but their movement was relatively quickly taken over by heretics. Most of the original Cathari seemed to be Baptist, but their movement was relatively quickly taken over by heretics. The Valdenses had missionaries in southern France, but they soon joined with the Albigenses. The Albigenses, Paulicians, and Valdenses were often in fellowship with one another and respected each other's baptism and ordination. The Albigenses developed their own hospitals, schools, and seminaries, while Roman Catholicism declined through the entire region. The independent groups were condemned by various church councils, and representatives of the established church were sent to persuade them to abandon their independent churches. Finally, Pope Innocent III ordered them destroyed by force. Destroyed by force. His order was carried out by the destruction of entire cities where the Albigenses had strong churches. The Albigenses were the objects of such hatred that the Catholic establishment was willing to kill thousands of faithful Catholics to be sure that all the Albigenses were slain. The bloody persecution continued for 20 years. Albigenses who survived hid in the forest or mountains or fled to refuge with the Valdenses. When a Catholic general was informed that many local Catholics were being killed during the Albigensian persecution, he replied, "Kill them all, let the Lord sort them out." So they would go to cities that where they knew there was a strong Albigensian presence, wipe out the entire city, even though the majority of the people in the city might be faithful Catholics. But they would kill the entire city, the entire town, entire village, to make sure they got all the Albigenses. The hatred and fear of this independent movement was so great that many, many thousands of loyal Catholics were killed in the process, just to be sure that you got everybody. And we mentioned Pope Innocent III, the most powerful of all the popes, maybe the most powerful man that ever lived in Europe. He would threaten interdict and say, "I'm going to send everyone in this country, this area, this region to hell if the leaders do not follow my orders." He threatened interdict 85 times, and all 85 times the rulers that he threatened interdict against obeyed him. Not a single successful challenge. This is an example of interdict. When the rulers of this area first received orders from Pope Innocent III to carry out such awful persecutions, they refused. They were not men sitting around the table looking for ways to kill innocent men, women, and children. But Pope Innocent III threatened interdict, which meant that he was going to send, according to them, he was going to send everybody in France to hell for eternity. No purgatory. Hell for eternity. The people put such pressure on the rulers because they believed that the rulers gave in and carried out these persecutions. Now, that's an illustration of several things. It's an illustration of how powerful Pope Innocent III was. Not many popes could pull off those kind of challenges. At one point, he ordered Prince John of England to sign over all his personal property to the Vatican. And of course, John's immediate response to that was one of anger, but then he threatened to send all of England to hell. And the people of England put such pressure on John that he ended up doing it. I mean, that gives you a sense of how powerful Pope Innocent III was. It also gives you a sense of how powerful the truth is and how much people fear the truth. And for a period of time, these churches operate out in the open. They're free. They don't have any obstacles and legal obstacles, and they're just flourishing. But you have to remember, things change. You cannot assume that because you have freedom today, you're going to have freedom tomorrow. And so Christians have to be prepared to be faithful regardless of what the set of circumstances are in an individual moment, in an individual day. And one of the things that's happened in some of the former communist countries that I have concerns about, that places like Vietnam, they've invited the underground churches to come out in the open. Boy, that sounds good. But you know what happens? This happened in Eastern Europe when the communists had it. They invited all, at one point they invited all, in the 1950s, they invited all the underground churches to come out in the open and you won't be persecuted. So they all came out in the open, and for several years they weren't persecuted. But when they were ready for the persecution, they knew where all the churches were and where all the people were. That's the reason they let them come out in the open, so that when they were ready, they could find them all. And I look at some of what's happening in some of the former communist countries where churches are encouraged right now to come out in the open, and right now they're not being persecuted, and it leaves me uncomfortable for what the future might be. The fact that things are one way today is not a guarantee that they'll be that way indefinitely. Well, B. Peter Burrus. Peter, around the year 1100 AD, Peter Burrus became a prominent independent Baptist preacher in France. He clearly advocated all of what we call the Baptist distinctives and suffered for his stand. He was banished from several areas, but he preached for 20 years in Toulouse. In 1126, he was seized by Catholic authorities and burnt at the stake. He's burned at the stake. Horribly unpleasant way to die. But you'll find several Baptist leaders of this era who die that way. Those influenced by his teachings formed independent churches and were called Petrobrusians. P-E-T-R-O, Petro, Brusians. B-R-U-S-I-A-N-S, Petrobrusians. P-E-T-R-O-B-R-U-S-I-A-N-S. Again, independent churches are being called by the name of a preacher that preached having independent churches. Now, they didn't leave many writings or much record. Can you imagine why they didn't leave many writings or much record? Yeah, being persecuted all the time. You don't exactly come out in the open and print something, or in their case, it had to have been handwritten, and say, it's produced over here, because you don't want people to know where it was produced. In one era in Vietnam, in every province, in every region, they required that ink be made to a specific formula for that region. That way, if they found Bibles or other forbidden books, they could tell right where they were printed at. And one of the things some of the believers did, and you folks probably don't remember the old cartridge pens that we had when I was a kid, but there was a little cartridge filled with ink, and you were expected to use that, and at certain times that's supposed to make you write carefully, improve your penmanship. It failed dramatically with me, but apparently worked with some other people. But there actually were Bibles produced in Vietnam where they used human blood. People would donate their blood. They'd have little cartridges of blood. They'd write the manuscript out by hand in blood so that if the authorities got it, they couldn't tell where it came from. Now, that was before DNA testing, which would be a whole different world today. But there was a period of time they actually did handwritten Bibles in Vietnam in human blood to avoid having the ink identified. Okay? Well, the Petrobrusians don't leave much record, understandably. But we know they were widespread and influential because the Catholic leadership kept calling councils to deal with them. You don't call a council to deal with one group of 30 over here. You'd only call church councils if something constituted a real threat. And they called several councils to deal with these people, which means they had to be widespread and exercising some influence. Henry of Lausanne. One of Peter's followers was Henry of Lausanne, who preached all over France and Switzerland. Entire Roman Catholic congregations left the established church and became independent. That's quite a story. Don't you wish we knew more about it? Don't know much. The only thing we know is that the Catholic Church is the one that tells us that happened. And of course, it infuriated him. Entire Roman Catholic congregations left the established church and became independent. These churches were known as Henricians. Henricians. Henry taught the truths that we currently call the Baptist distinctives. He was arrested after being declared a heretic by Catholic leadership and died in an underground prison around 1148 AD. An underground prison, cold, dark, damp. He eventually gets pneumonia in those circumstances, gets no medical treatment, and dies from the pneumonia. The Swiss Anabaptists, 400 years later, claimed that their churches sprang from the Henricians and Petrobrusians who fled to the Alps. And the Henricians and Petrobrusians claimed that their churches came from the Paulicians and Albigenses. Georgius Cassiander, a Catholic writer, wrote of Peter and Henry, "They first openly condemned infant baptism and stiffly asserted that baptism was fit only for the adult, which they both verbally taught and really practiced in their administration of baptism." He said, these folks not only taught it, they practiced it. They didn't take their children to be sprinkled. There were some Catholic theologians along the way that would question whether they were doing it right, but they never defied the church by not doing it. But he said, these men not only taught this, they actually did it. Arnold of Brescia, which is a tremendously interesting story to me. Arnold of Brescia was a lifelong campaigner for separation of church and state. Lifelong campaigner for separation of church and state. And his work caused him to be banned from one country after another. Lifelong campaigner for separation of church and state. And his work caused him to be banned from one country after another. He finally moved to Rome, where his strong teaching led the people of Rome to overthrow the Pope and drive him from the city. He led them in overthrowing the Pope and driving him from the city. In the history of Rome, that is not a very common experience. Especially, I don't think it's paralleled from a grassroots movement. What times the Pope is run out of Rome or imprisoned in Rome, it's by a country. Arnold preaches him out of Rome. And again, we don't know a lot about this, and you'll see why in a second. For a time, the people of Rome were free, and many independent churches operated openly. I mean, in Rome itself. For a time, the people of Rome were free, and many independent churches operated openly. Arnold identified himself with the Baptist distinctives. It means main thrust was separation of church and state, but he believed all these things. Remember I had said earlier that every preacher, there'll be one or two or three things that you become noted for. You may believe hundreds of things, but one or two, three things you become noted for. Okay? In my case, and this comes up if you just look at my invitations to preach, I'm noted for emphasizing a clear gospel, King James Bible and Received Text, and Baptist distinctives. Trust me when I tell you I believe hundreds of other things. But those are the three things people associate with my name. What people associated with Arnold's name, very understandably, was separation of church and state. But it's clear he believed everything we call Baptist distinctive today. Okay? He gained, and soon many of the independent churches were called Arnoldus. He gained many followers in the Italian region of Lombardy. For hundreds of years, advocates of separation of church and state in Italy were to be called Lombards, because there were so many of them in that region of Italy. They were called Lombards. Unfortunately, military forces loyal to the Pope retook Rome, and Arnold was captured and hanged. His body was burned, and his ashes were thrown into the Tiber River. They thought they were going to keep him from ever resurrecting from the dead by destroying his body. They're in for a surprise someday. Many of his followers were also killed. So why do we not have much record of the Arnoldus? Forces loyal to the Pope retake Rome. They hang Arnold. They burn his body. They sweep through the city. They destroy all the independent church buildings and everything connected with them. So there's very little record of what the Arnoldus produced left. How do we know about him? Catholic Church history, which paints Arnold as a horrible, evil man. And he was so evil, he didn't even believe in baptizing babies. He was so evil, he didn't believe in the control of the Pope over the state. He was so evil, his churches were independent. So evil, the churches, you couldn't join him until after you made a profession of faith. The record about him is totally given negative. But we read through the record and say, what a good man. But the records of the Arnoldus themselves, I'd like to know what happened when they first took over Rome. I'd like to know how many people quit going to the Catholic Church and started going to the independent church. I mean, there's a lot of things I'd like to know. But all of their records were destroyed as their churches were destroyed and their preachers were killed. So we don't have records from them. We have much. We have records of the Roman Catholic Church attacking them. But from that, you come up with a lot of interesting things. The Arnoldus later identified themselves with the Waldenses, as did most of the Petrobrusians, Henricians, and surviving Albigenses. And the survivors would flee to the Swiss Alps. Matter of fact, in many of the history books of the time, it was called the Israel of the Alps. They would flee to the Alps, they'd go to the mountain churches, they strengthened, and this is why it's almost amazing, you see this throughout centuries, that there are no Catholic churches and no heretical churches among the Waldenses. But the Waldensian movement keeps getting strengthened by all these people who flee into it, and they know what the score is, they know what it's like, they know what matters, they know what the issues are in teaching the truth. And so they keep getting strengthened, and it's not that they have any laws forbidding heretical churches, but gospel believers keep getting strengthened in the Alps by these folks who come in, who have been faithful enough to risk their lives, understanding enough to be loyal to the Bible, and who are very conscious of the fact that they don't want all this bad stuff in their churches. So you find this movement in the Alps where village after village after village has one church, and it's a gospel-preaching church. That's a hard thing for us to comprehend. 3 years ago, I was in India, and I was in a region of India that at once upon a time was famous for headhunters. Now, the headhunting stopped back in the late 1800s. But I was in one village that had over 300 people in it, living in it, and over 200 of them belonged to the local Baptist church. And there was no other church anywhere around. Either went to the Baptist church or not at all. We don't know anything like that. The United States and the Philippines, we don't know anything similar to that. But this is what happened with the Waldenses. And in parts of the world, you find similar things today. I understand where I'm going in the Amazon River Basin in August, you would find many villages that have just one religious assembly, and it's a gospel-preaching church. We know nothing of that here, what that's like. Well, Berengarius. We don't know much about Berengarius, except what the Catholics taught about him. Berengarius was the director of the Catholic schools in Tours, France. His study of the scriptures led him to teach baptism by immersion of believers only, and that the Lord's Supper was only an ordinance. He was declared a heretic. He was declared a heretic. He spent the rest of his life in isolation. The rest of his life in isolation. He had many followers who often formed independent churches. Followers who formed independent churches. One Catholic writer estimated that the combined membership of those independent churches was over 800,000. The only thing we know about them is what the Catholic Church said about them. Wouldn't you like to have more history than that? I'd like to know how he went from being one isolated man fired from being the director of the Catholic schools to a man who influenced forming independent churches that eventually had over 800,000 members. That'd be a story. Little of known is what happened to that movement. Why do we have no record of that movement? Well, for one thing, this happened during the reign of Innocent III. And while we don't have even the Catholic records, can you imagine that Innocent III looked the other way with a group of 800,000 in Italy and France? Pretty likely they had the same fate as the Albigenses. The records of where they were at, their preachers were killed, their buildings were destroyed, their records were destroyed. Most likely that's what happened. But the reason we know they existed is because one Roman Catholic writer talks about them, and in the most terrible terms. He thought these were the most horrible, wicked, ungodly people. They had independent churches, and they wouldn't baptize babies. And they preached salvation by faith. What evil, terrible, horrible people, you know, from our perspective. But from their perspective, they were evil, terrible, horrible people. One of the things I tried to do in my little book on Baptist history, which is reflected in these notes, some of the books on Baptist history cover some of the most famous groups. I have also tried to find the groups over which there's just a little bit of mention here and there. I suspect we don't know a fraction of the truth of people who honored the Bible and the gospel throughout these centuries. We just get a little bit here and there, mostly from their enemies. And if there was a group the Catholic Church didn't bother to write about, we probably don't have any record of them. I suspect in heaven, I really hope I'm right, I suspect in heaven we're going to find the stories of all kinds of people that knew the Lord and preached the gospel that we didn't even know existed. I think even to this day, one of the folks who've studied this been amazed in China since the development of the internet. People have identified hundreds of gospel-preaching churches that nobody knew was there, some of which are Baptist churches and others who've preached the gospel. And people said, you know, and people said, these churches that have been spotted on the internet have a combined membership of over 1 million. Which leads you to a question, how many churches have we not spotted where people preaching the gospel there? I hope lots. I hope heaven is going to have a whole lot more people in it than you might first guess from studying church history. And I have a suspicion that that will be true. Because we got this little piece of the record and that little piece of the record and that little piece of the record. Who knows how much we don't have? I'm hoping it turns out there's a lot of places the gospel was preached and did its work and people found Christ, and one day we'll fellowship with them in heaven and we didn't even know, even after you took church history class, you still didn't know they existed. Okay? And that's my hope. Let's take a break.